This show was brought to you by Ouch My Ego, ouchmyego.com.
Welcome back to the show, Ken.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
When we last spoke, we were talking about some zany escape film that kind of doesn't make too much sense.
Yeah, Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Yeah, I think we're in the same kind of territory, but totally different style of filmmaking here.
Yeah, this movie's actually enjoyable.
Well, before we get to that, also, last time you had just dropped an album. What else you got on your plate?
Kind of nothing. Just plugging along with the podcast. I've been doing a lot of cons, running Q&As and stuff like that. So, nothing. I thought about doing a second record. I have the material, but just haven't really gotten off my ass and done it.
Well, you've been busy, though.
Yeah.
You've been running around like a chicken with your head cut off.
Yep, running around. We got a new puppy. You know, it's a busy adult life.
Indeed it is. So, now, you said this watchable film. Well, what is it? What did we just watch?
Tourist Trap.
Every year, hundreds of young people travel the country and disappear. God help those who get caught in the tourist trap. Tourist Trap, where beautiful young people looking for excitement are tricked, terrorized.
Mr. Johnson!
Trapped.
Let go!
Tourist Trap. Shock you can see. Terror you can feel. Heart-stopping suspense that makes this the nightmare that never ends. Something crazy's going on at the tourist trap.
By David Schmoller.
So this movie came out in 1978?
Yes. It was Charles Band production. One of his very good movies, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it's available on Blu-ray.
Yes.
Under Full Moon.
Yep.
But was it a Full Moon film?
No, this predates Full Moon. So Charles Band started Full Moon in 1989 after Empire Pictures had crumbled. This movie actually predates Empire Pictures. Empire produced stuff like Reanimator and Catacombs and The Eliminators and Cellar Dweller.
But Rage War.
Yep, but this movie predates that when he was kind of just doing one-off movies like Laser Blast and Fairy Tales and this movie.
This film is about young adults. They're not high schoolers. They're not college kids.
Yeah, they're probably college-ish.
They're definitely not college.
They're probably like, early 20s. Although this is 1978 college kids, and you and I are of similar age, so I think college kids in 1978 are going to look like our parents to us and are going to look older.
Right, that's what I'm getting at, particularly the men.
Yes.
So college kids or college-age kids, their cars get screwed up. Two different cars get screwed up.
One of which is like a dune buggy type car, which is so very 70s.
Is that the one with the most of the people in it?
Yeah, it's kind of like a Jeep, kind of like a dune buggy.
I think it's a European car. I think maybe Italian.
Okay.
But I think we call them frogs.
Okay.
Or maybe that's a different car that's similar. It's probably the different one.
Maybe it is Italian.
But,
and it's related to the man who did the score of this film, Mr. Pino Donaggio.
Maybe it's his car.
Could be his car.
Pino Donaggio, eh?
Yep, who did...
Now, the score is bizarre. The movie starts with this weird score, actually. The credits are boring, mundane, but the music is whimsical.
It's like Tom Waits.
Yeah, you think so?
It's got kind of that weird, like, it's wood like block and, like, kind of like, bum, bum, dun. It's like a weird circus. You know, it kind of reminds me... It reminds me a little bit of the music that Richard Band, Charles Band's brother, did for the movie Dolls later.
Right. Maybe that informed... Yeah, I mean, because Richard Band is always informed by other people's music.
Yes, the Bernard Herrmann Reanimator.
Yeah, that was what I was getting at. Thanks for picking it up. So this... Who are the kids? I know one of them in particular is Tanya Roberts.
Right, she's really...
Who I couldn't stop looking at.
Right, she's really probably the only name out of any of the cast. It's a pretty... faceless cast of actors, but you do have Tanya Roberts here. This is pre-Sheena, pre-James Bond. She looks stunning. She's like an absolute showstopper, but not the star. She's just kind of one of the girls. It's a very similar setup to Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Okay, all right. So this is not territory that we've never been until.
Right.
As I started watching this movie, I was like, why is this even the suggestion? This is a slasher, right? Because I had seen it once before many years ago, and my memory of it served me rather poorly.
Right.
I remembered the tube tops, Tanya Roberts, and that's kind of about it, right?
So you probably saw it around puberty?
No. I mean, I saw this like 8 years ago or something.
Okay.
No, not puberty. No. I still like Tanya Roberts. I always had. What I saw of Tanya Roberts when I was going through my formative years was Beastmaster.
Yes.
So I...
And that 70s show.
Oh, no, not that. I don't watch TV.
Right.
Unless it's Twin Peaks. Right. There it is, everybody. Take a drink.
Yep.
There's a drinking game now on my podcasts. Whenever I mention Twin Peaks, everybody take a drink. So that's twice.
There you go.
In this show. The first car gets a flat or something, right? Is that
Yeah, and then they all have to pile into the dune buggy car.
Oddly, I was completely confused at this scene. Maybe I think I was dealing with my cat, because I came back and I saw the guy walking to the wherever he walked to, the tourist trap, I guess, and he had, I don't know if he had anything with him, but I thought he had a gas can.
Yeah.
But then they have a flat?
Yeah.
So there was this one detail at the very beginning that I lost.
Maybe he's just going to set the car on fire. He's like, it's got a flat. It's a lost cause. Just burn it to the ground.
So he had a gas can?
I remember him having a gas can, yes.
Right. That's silly if they have a flat. But their friends pick up the other girl, his girlfriend or wife. I know Tanya Roberts is the wife of the other guy.
Yeah, I think they're just girlfriends.
That's mentioned in the movie once.
Right.
So they're like the only couple.
Right.
Like married couple, which is actually interesting that they just toss that detail in and don't really reference it ever.
Right. It has nothing to do with the plot.
After that. Right. Which is what, though? What is the plot?
We have Mr. Slauson's tourist trap.
Yeah,
which,
get to it.
You know, I've been to places like that. I don't know if you have, if you've ever driven across the United States. They're few and far between now.
I have.
But they're, you know, these weird little mom and pop attempts to, you know, make a little money as people are on the side of the road. They were usually near a hotel or motel, rather. You know, they'd be kind of like a little general store. But they'd also be like, "We're the Barbed Wire Museum," or so, you know, something silly like that. And this guy runs a place like that. It's essentially a little wax museum, sort of mixed with a general store. And that is the tourist trap that we mentioned. The kids kind of give up on, you know, they decide to go in a swimming hole, and that's when Chuck Connors, as Mr. Slauson, shows up, telling them that
I thought I'd better come down and warn you. You all best leave before it gets dark.
What happens at dark?
Well, this here hole fills up with water moccasins. If you feel something wiggling around your feet, it's just the early ones come to find a good spot.
Now, as far as tourist traps go, I visited two, at least that I remember. One of them was a petrified forest. Mm-hmm. It was just a bunch of, they actually just moved petrified wood to the location. It was in the middle of the desert.
Okay.
And the other one had, I don't think it was Thing. Do you know what Thing is?
Thing?
You drive by and a billboard is like, what is,
oh,
no, It.
Is yeah, it. You're 10 miles closer to It, that whole thing.
Right. It. So it wasn't It, but it was something. Thing like it.
Yeah, like the mystery spot or that those kind of places.
We walked in and it's this stingy little country store type of thing. It's also in the desert. I think it was in New Mexico or something. And we didn't go through the maze or anything, but it's this maze. We just peered in and looked.
Right.
It was like $5 to do it. But it was a bunch of like jackalope stuff.
Oh yeah. And that's very classic Americana. Like I remember there was one we used to go to up in Lake George, New York, and it was sort of a wax museum, but it was the worst looking wax dolls like you've ever seen in your life. And it reminds me of this movie. This movie also would make, I think, a good double feature with Toby Hooper's Funhouse. It's kind of a very good, a similar vibe.
All right, yeah. So two Toby Hooper movies referenced in this film.
Yep.
Interesting. The wax museum here, they're more like animatronic?
Yeah, they're like animatronic mannequins.
Automatons?
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, they're basically, yeah, mannequins that he's, in theory, that he's mechanized to do, you know, little acts.
So the kids are there to get their car fixed. Chuck Connors owns this place, and he mentions his crazy brother and his dead wife.
Yep.
And there's a representation of his dead wife
in the tourist trap
as a mannequin.
Yep.
And he talks about what his brother used to bring to the trap, which was the automaton mechanics.
Right. He was a genius.
Which is just a guy dressed up as a
mannequin. Not within the plot of the movie, just as a special effect.
Yeah, the special effect. I'm like, where they need those breakdancers from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey.
Yeah.
They need Ozone.
It's a very low budget movie, but part of that is why I think I like it so much. Like, I actually think this is a better movie than Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Okay, I'm with you. I'm totally with you on that. This second time watching it, I was constantly saying, what?
Yeah.
How is that?
Yeah.
Why? What? Where's the explanation? But I don't need it.
Yeah.
I want it. I don't need it.
It's like a nightmare.
Now, why don't I need it? You know why.
Because it's effective. You still get scared. And you don't need the explanation because they give you one later.
Oh, do they really, though? It's just the guy saying so.
I think so. I mean, the ending is nonsensical, but I think the explanation is plausible. It veers into supernatural territory that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre does not.
Okay. It is supernatural then. Okay. I don't mind. This movie came out in 78.
I don't think it's...
spoiled the heck out of it. So you could be explicit.
Yeah. So it essentially, if you combined Texas Chainsaw Massacre with Carrie and Dressed to Kill, you'd basically get this movie.
I figured you might go to Carrie.
Yeah. Which, again, Pino Donaggio's score.
He was maybe sitting there like, this is a simple slasher film and not a good... I was just working on Carrie, you know?
Only the telekinesis. It's a movie.
Right, it's exactly. That's my Italian.
Yeah, I mean, David Schmoller had seen Carrie and enjoyed it, which I think is evident, you know, with a lot of this movie, and that's where he wanted to get Pino Donaggio to do the score. And this was Schmoller's first full-length movie. He'd made a student film before this called, I think it was called The Spider's Web, that was really terrifying and weird and very Argento-y. Huh. So he kind of brought that to this. So he pitched this to Charles Band as a slasher movie, as a Texas Chainsaw Massacre slasher movie, but what we get is this heightened, bizarre, surreal nightmare movie.
It is a nightmare.
Where it's not just that Mr. Slauson is a murderer, he's telekinetic, he thinks he's also his own twin brother, and he's sort of turning people into mannequins and or making them lose their minds as he kills them.
Yeah, nightmare is the perfect word for this. Try to describe it from a first-person perspective, and it would be as though you're trying to describe a nightmare that you just had, and you're not really clear on.
Yeah. Because... it has that nightmare logic, like, and it's shot in a way where it feels like you're watching as an observer, and then you're part of it, and then you're far away, you know, like you have in a nightmare.
Yeah.
And you kind of don't know which end is up. It's illogical, but it's not complete nonsense, if that makes any sense. Like, it fits within the context of the movie. It's not like, say, you know, when we were looking at Beyond the Black Rainbow, and I'm sure we'll get, you know, in 2 years, angry emails again. but a lot of that was just, you know, nonsensical shock factories, you know, where it was just like, here's incongruous things, here's another thing and another thing and another thing. This all fits within the world of this movie.
Yeah, so the kids do end up splitting up at times against...
bad idea.
Yeah, it's a bad idea, and it's always been a bad idea. But here, I think the actors bring a sort of maturity, really, because they're not like Friday the 13th teens or young adults. They seem to be a bit more mature about everything. Like I said, we've got a married couple.
Yeah, they're not horned up. They're not like, hey, we're in a bad situation, let's all smoke doobage and do it.
Right, right. But, I mean, you still have the hot representation. Two of the ladies are rather attractive ladies. One of them is kind of homely. And the homely one is also the survivor, which is kind of
final girl.
Telltale. When you have a sort of homely girl, she's probably not going to get killed.
You know what it fascinates me the most about this movie is that it's rated PG.
Yeah. I mean, okay, when you're watching it, you're like, this is too nuts, this is too bizarre, this is too crazy. Inexplicable things are happening, there's some horrific murders. It's not too bloody. In fact, I think blood only happened once, and that actually I was really bummed about. Those Tanya Roberts eating it, she got
right.
A knife gets thrown in the back of her head, and that you see a little bit of blood. As they showed, I was following her character, and I was like, I forgot this movie, right? So I'm like, she's got to be the final girl, and she's not.
Right.
And I was...
she's got the star power.
It totally was like the rug out from under my feet. I was bummed.
She's good in this movie too. I think removing the sort of sex equals death part of the slasher movie, which this predates Friday the 13th and, you know, obviously is after Halloween, but by sort of removing that aspect of it, it makes you like the characters better. They seem a little bit more fully formed, even though, you know, they're not totally fleshed out, but because they don't just seem like horned up cannon fodder, you know, and obviously Tanya Roberts is naturally likable. And even the other people who, you know, I don't think I've seen in anything before or since seem real and natural. And like you said, you know, a little savvier, like that you're not going, that's what you deserve because you did something stupid.
Right. Nobody deserves any of this except, you know, the dumb, foolish trope of I'm going out to look alone.
Eileen, don't go out there. If I'm not back in 10 minutes, form a posse.
Which is what a couple of characters did, and then they get taken out. But you're saying, like, they don't sexualize the characters other than how they're dressed.
Yeah, and the little skinny dipping scene at the very beginning, but they're not...
but that's not even sexualizing anything.
Yeah.
That's... actually, it allows for a moment where Chuck Connors is, like, possibly a creep.
Yeah.
But then he continues talking to them as if they're clothed.
Yeah.
He doesn't even acknowledge that they're naked.
And Chuck Connors is a fascinating actor. I mean, he's from Boston. He was actually on the Boston Celtics in the 50s. He was a member of the Boston Celtics basketball team. Also played baseball. I believe he got an injury, and then he moved to Hollywood and started acting in Westerns. He was in Branded and The Rifleman, and had a pretty illustrious career, and then had some public sort of issues, and was sort of not someone people wanted to work with after a while, and was doing these kind of movies, and then later went on to be the bad guy on Spencer for Hire, and was the main werewolf in the TV show Werewolf on Fox.
Yeah.
But he has an interesting quality as an actor where he's menacing. I mean, he's a big dude too. He was 6'6" and a pretty intimidating dude, but he has a warmth-ish where you think he might be helpful. Like, he seems a little bit likable. Not just psychotic.
In particularly in this film, he is exactly portrayed that way.
Yeah, you think he's...
Like I said, he doesn't even acknowledge that they're naked. He's just like hanging out in the water and all.
That's what people do. Hey, yeah. Watch out for them moccasins.
Okay, it's kind of predictable. You know that he's going to be the bad guy.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, they telegraphed
it. I knew that he was going to be the bad guy. But in what means? Was he going to be one of the bad guys? Were there more than one? Because it seems like there's more than one.
Yeah, for a while. I remember when I first saw this, I thought it really was a twin brother.
Right. But, there really was, but he's dead.
Right. There isn't in the time frame of this movie, the twin brother is not in the picture.
Right. So this also follows Psycho a little bit, the dissociative identity disorder. Psycho, Carrie, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So Psycho, you had Norman Bates flip out and think that he's his own mother and use her as the means for him to dispose of people. Here you have Mr. Slauson do the same but use his brother's identity.
Sort of. He also wears women's, wigs and women's clothes occasionally too, though.
Right. So there's that.
And that just kind of goes unquestioned. The reason you can't tell if it's him or his twin brother for a lot of the movie, aside from, presumably
the voice.
The voice he uses is different.
You're so pretty.
And he wears a mask that is essentially a blank mannequin face.
It's done in a way that's really interesting that I've never seen before this movie, or since, I guess. It's split at the mouth, right. So it's kind of like the split mouth woman Japanese thing.
Like a ventriloquist almost.
Yeah, the jaw is actually also part of the mask, but it comes up under the top part, so it's like the top part's kind of a flap over the jaw.
It has that quality that David Cronenberg's mask has in Nightbreed, where it's sort of doll-like and blank, and as a result is absolutely horrifying.
Oh, well, there's a couple of them, right? So there's the one down in the basement, and he's got the guy chained up. He just brings Tanya Roberts down and ties her up, and there's a woman laying. Is that their friend, or is that a different woman? That is their friend?
I believe it's their friend, yeah.
Okay. I thought maybe it was a different woman who was just there for expository because she starts telling him.
He's going to kill us. I was stopping for gas along the highway. I never even saw him coming. He's crazy. We're all going to die.
But she's strapped to the thing. He's putting dough on her face, which is supposed to be plaster of Paris.
It's plaster. Yeah, he's making a plaster cast.
It's dough.
Yeah.
It's not going to hurt her. It's like, it's just floured dough. But it's supposed to be plaster, but it's supposed to heat up, and he doesn't give her any air holes or anything to breathe out of. And so she dies through fear, basically.
She suffocates.
No, he says...
Your world is dark. It's getting hard to breathe, isn't it? I'm going to seal the last opening. You won't be able to breathe, but you won't suffocate. Your heart will burst from fright before you lose consciousness.
Oh, right. On the soundtrack, there's her beating heart gets louder and louder.
Right, right. And so she dies, but that mask that he's wearing is like kind of this weird Elvis mask.
Yes.
It's weird because he has this primping scene right before that, where he puts on this hat and he makes sure everything looks
okay. Yeah,
it's like
a fisherman's cap. Right?
Yeah. And then he comes down the stairs, introduces himself, and immediately throws the hat into the corner. I was like, why?
He just needed it to get there. He's like, I'm the skipper for this 1 minute, and now I don't need it anymore. I don't need the confidence.
Maybe that's what it was. I need the confidence to get downstairs with this awkward mask that it can hardly see out of.
Right. Right.
So let's just put something else that might obstruct my vision on my head.
and at this point, it's when they start to introduce the concept of, he's telekinetic, so the mannequins, he makes them move all around him, and as he's gonna kill someone, or as he gets more sort of amped up, the mannequins get into, more of a fury, and that is nuts. The soundtrack gets crazy. There's one particular mannequin that doesn't look like a normal mannequin. It's clearly got like a custom face and it laughs.
Yeah.
You probably know the one I'm talking about. I went to a horror convention here in Massachusetts in about 2001, and the guy who built that was there and had that mannequin with him.
Ooh.
And I was horrified.
I thought maybe you'd be like a pig in mud rolling around in that mannequin, you know, as it were.
I mean, you know, now in hindsight, it's kind of cool that I got to see that thing in person. But, you know, especially where you're not expecting, this is a very obscure movie. It really is only in the last year or two that I've noticed more people watching it or talking about it. But that was a really obscure, weird thing to have at a convention in Massachusetts.
Yeah. I don't go to enough conventions. I just don't.
Yeah, this, you're not missing much.
I know. I've been to one. I've been to Comic-Con. Actually, I've been to two. I've been to Comic-Con in 2001 and, or the year, maybe 2000. I forget. And I've been to one in Nashville, a tattoo and horror festival or something. And
okay.
Yeah, that was like a church auditorium sized thing. It was tiny. Yeah. And we were like,
sometimes that can be fun.
We're like, oh, like, yeah. Well, I got a Hulk action figure out of it. That's it.
Nice. Chuck Connors could have played the Hulk.
You think so?
Well, you know who Chuck Connors would have been a good? Was it General Thunderbolt? What's that guy? The villain in the Hulk in the comic?
Yeah.
General Ross, Thunderbolt Ross, was that his name?
Yes.
He would have been great as that character.
Who would then eventually turn into Red Hulk. It's not like a follow comics,
yes,
though, people,
which would be.
Because I actually
right,
don't.
Would be horrifying.
But I just somehow pick up this dumb information comics. However, yeah, I think so. Chuck Connors in the Marvel Universe. You know, they've got these posters that people are doing where it's like vintage style Marvel Universe stuff. Do one of Chuck Connors.
They could, because he is deceased.
Like a recasting with old actors is what I mean.
Okay, yeah. He would be great as Thunderbolt Ross, Red Hulk. Terrifying and great.
Okay, so when I saw Chuck Connors' name in the credits, I was like, oh, Chuck Connors. Because my most exposure to him is two things. Rifleman, which is, you know, nice guy.
Yeah.
And Werewolf, which was, he's just too old.
Yeah, he's basically a grizzled old sea captain in that.
Right. I remember not liking Werewolf eventually. Like,
yeah,
it's a werewolf show. I'm going to watch it, of course. Oh, five episodes in, I don't really like this.
It was pretty boring.
Yeah. Around the same time, Swamp Thing.
Also boring.
Was happening. Yeah. I guess TV liked these kinds of monsters at the time, and now we don't have any. But here, his psychic activity in the basement, well, pre-basement, we don't know why all these mannequins are flipping out, but we end up learning right in the basement why. But the scene where all the mannequins start flipping out right before when he captures Tanya Roberts, it's amazing.
Yeah.
This is where, like, the first what is really happening.
Oh, that scene where they all start falling on top?
Yeah, yeah. You see through previously the silly gags with the man dressed up like he's a mannequin.
Right.
And he's supposed to actually be a mannequin. You see through those gags. But this, there's no people dressed up as mannequins. They're just mannequins being puppeted around. Like, some guy on the floorboards is, like, yanking a mannequin around by its legs. Just basically hitting Tanya Roberts with it.
Right. Which I'm sure is someone's fetish.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. It looks, this movie just is too much of a nightmare.
Well, it triggers that, you know, sense of the uncanny where, you know, anything that looks human enough to unsettle you when you know it's not human. And I think that's why people are afraid of mannequins, to find them, you know, creepy. And this really, really, really capitalizes on that big time.
Yeah.
It manages to also make the mannequins even creepier because they're out of context. So, like, mannequins can be creepy in a, you know, department store. And, you know, there's that famous Twilight Zone episode that takes place in a department store and is about creepy mannequins. But it's extra creepy in this because you have mannequins in the middle of nowhere in some old guy's house.
Yeah, kind of. And it's a weird, it's a set. So it's a little bit obvious at the beginning of the movie anyway that the house that it has the initial mannequins, including his wife. It's like a wider set, so the camera can move around a lot more.
Right.
I wish it was a little bit tighter looking, anyway. I wish there was more clutter, but I've been to too many antique stores. That's basically it.
It was not authentic.
Yeah, it's not authentic to a Cracker Barrel, even.
Right.
But, well, getting to the wife mannequin, that's actually her, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, he's sort of... So that this is where it sort of goes into House of Wax territory.
Yeah.
Where he's sort of made real people into the mannequins. Through some sort of bizarre combination of, you know, tradesman skills and psychokinesis.
Now, the psychokinesis down in the basement, the guy is about to get a key. He's brings a key towards him that's on the floor because he can't touch it with his hands. Yeah. He brings it with his foot.
You have hope.
And he's about to get it. Then it just moves back to where it was.
Yep.
And then the guy explains that he has or telekinesis.
Yep.
Which is inexplicable as well, like his whole poor me speech about it.
My brother doesn't like me to do that stuff. He pretends he doesn't even know about my power. But it feels good when I use it. I shouldn't have to hide it. I mean, I can control it. I can. I shouldn't have to hide it. It feels good.
Why are you talking?
Yeah. Well, he's a nutcase. Like, he's clearly, you know, fractured. And, you know, it almost reminded me, not to bring it back to comics, but, you know, the version of Legion in the comics, who's Charles Xavier's son, the way they explain his powers is he has, you know, thousands of split personalities, and each personality has a different, you know, psychic ability. And so it's almost like that. Like, he uses this power as a separate entity. And, you know, psychic abilities was pretty popular in the 70s.
Right. That's true. Like, ESP was a brain tickler. My mom, who was rather religious, and I don't talk about it too often, she was always warning against anything with ESP in it. So, ET...
Right, because it's a cult, right?
Occult activity.
Is corrupting.
ESP in ET, between Elliot and ET, she saw that as sort of evil or something.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's... None of it's real?
Well, I think that, it, you know, culturally, I think that 70s obsession with occult things and, you know, fringe science and In Search Of and, you know, Chariots of the Gods and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That, in a lot of ways, that fed directly into the Satanic Panic stuff of the 80s. So it's all kind of, you know, related in that way.
Definitely. So no wonder I hadn't seen this all throughout the 80s and into the 90s, you know? I saw this
in your adult life. I had the opposite effect. My dad made me go see this with him at a theater.
Oh, really? You're going to go see this movie now.
We love Tonya Roberts, and I don't know why this was playing here, and it wasn't a drive-in, but it was kind of a CD theater around like 81 or 82. But I guess, you know, some of these movies...
Was it in Combat Zone or what?
I don't remember. No, it wasn't in the zone. I think we're in Waltham, Mass, which had a great toy store called Mr. Big's Toyland that sold, like, Ultraman and, you know, Gigantor toys. But I remember being in sort of a suburban-y place. It wasn't in the combat zone. But it was weird that, you know, this movie from 4 years ago was playing in a movie theater. But I guess at that point, we were still having that sort of roadshow thing because video wasn't that big. And, you know, we probably figured...
And I wasn't around.
You weren't around.
I wasn't in America at the time. No, I was still in Europe.
Was Germany that you were in it?
Holland,
right.
Netherlands.
And, you know, they it was rated PG. So, you know, I'm going to take my kid to a PG movie with Tonya Roberts in it, and I don't see what the big deal is. But then it was on USA Network a lot in the 80s. It was on USA Saturday Nightmares.
Okay.
Very frequently. This played on TV a lot.
Wow. So how long was Saturday Nightmares on for, do you
Saturday
think?
Nightmares went from 1984 till about 1993. It was every Saturday.
Really?
Yeah, it was sort of less... the early 90s, it wasn't every Saturday. They would show a movie from 8 to 10, and then from 10 to 11, they would show the Ray Bradbury Theater, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, or The Hitchhiker. And as it got into the 90s, they started to scrap the movie and would just have that hour or 2 hour block of, you know, The Hitchhiker, Ray Bradbury Theater, and the new Alfred Hitchcock, and then Up All Night. But it was on when Night Flight was on.
I totally missed Night Flight. I moved here in 85, here Earth. No. America. Moved to California in 85 and got cable, I think, around 87.
Yeah, so it was still on at that point. But so. I remember the movies I remember the most from Saturday Nightmares was Neon Maniacs was on all the time. A movie with Linda Blair called
I missed that.
Grotesque, which is a bizarre movie. And this movie. Those three movies were on all the time on Saturday Nightmares.
See, Neon Maniacs we've covered already. And
love it.
I discovered that on my own in the late 90s. So... You're lucky that you got all these like cheap production houses packages thrown at cable.
Yeah, and I think
those
three movies
I missed a bunch of that.
You did, but you also, I mean, like Neon Maniacs doesn't really have any nudity. There's some violence in it, but not a lot that really needs to get cut out. And the same with Tourist Trap. I mean, this basically aired on television totally uncut.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why it would be cut. Like I said, like you said even, like it's PG and we have the head scratcher to it, but it's all context as to why we're scratching our heads. Right. It's not because of the content.
Right.
Right?
Oh, totally.
Just the head stab and, well, the tube top. Right. Because it's amazing.
It truly is.
I keep going on, but... Seriously, watch the movie, and if you're watching, I assume you're not blind.
Or if you are, you'll regain sight. It's that good.
I was totally bummed when she got killed. But there's a shot of Connors walking down, I guess, concrete slab stairs or something. He's walking down a hill,
right.
And there are these pylons on either side. But every time he walks by a pylon, he grabs onto it and swings.
Yeah, like a child.
Swings his body around.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre. I wonder if that's him. I wonder if it's a character choice.
I think it's a character choice on his part.
I wonder if... You think so?
Because his brother...
I know that he was limping through the film.
Yeah, he did a limp so that he could show... I think it was a red herring limp so that, you know, Slauson limps, but his brother doesn't. So you would go, oh, you know, right. It's not the same person. One guy limps, the other one doesn't. But there's also a strange thing where his brother that he's playing died at a much younger age. So he plays his brother as a kind of child because presumably that's how old his brother was when he died.
Yeah, well, his brother died because he was cavorting
with his wife.
Yeah.
Or, you know, maybe he's playing...
And so he didn't want to kill him.
He's playing his brother back before he and his brother, you know, had issues with the ladies. It's a very childlike, innocent-ish portrayal when he's the brother, which leads to that, like...
Yeah, but there's a resentment that the brother version has about the right. Big brother, that he's like, he doesn't like how handsome I am.
Right.
So I have to wear this mask.
Which okay, totally, that's, that totally makes sense.
No. It's usually the opposite. In fact, if I ever have some problem with my face, I want to get like a custom sort of Daft Punk-ish kind of helmet mask for me.
Yep.
So I don't have to disgust people all the time.
Yeah.
I just have to make it so that it has respirators inside so I don't suffocate.
Right. You don't want all the, and you don't want to have a heart attack while having the plaster cast made out of pizza dough on your face.
Right. Yeah. You gotta have nose holes. So all the telekinetic stuff just was a surprise.
Yeah.
As it was happening.
And I think it was intended to be, which is cool.
Everything was surprising. The moment when Tanya Roberts gets killed, always coming back to that, all these other mannequins, which are actually the men dressed up as if they're mannequins, the suit performers, they just start shooting at her. So there's Custer or something like that.
Yep.
There's another soldier, and there's a Native American. A Native American throws a tomahawk, and you think that's going to get her. And I was thinking maybe she should just grab the tomahawk, and maybe they're going to go that way. Nope. Then throws a knife at her, and she kind of stands still and lets it hit her.
Yeah, she's paralyzed with fear.
Okay, thank you. You're making this movie make sense.
Well, the thing that happens after that is the most nonsensical, which is when our hero girl, the final girl, thinks she's going to be saved because it's not her boyfriend, but one of the other guys basically shows up like, you know, I'm going to save you now. And then
it's Tanya Roberts' husband.
And she's like, great, I'm saved. And then he turns into a mannequin to his shock and her shock.
He just kind of freezes after he's like, come on, let's go. Then Chuck Connors comes over and rips his arm off.
Yeah.
And then bashes the face into the ground and it breaks like porcelain.
Yeah, so it's like Chuck Connors was just messing with her.
This movie's screwy.
It is, and it sticks with you.
And how he set that up, like, so quickly. Everything is so quickly.
He's just sitting around his tourist trap for years thinking of this stuff. He's got nothing going on. He's just waiting.
Or is he just waiting? Because it seems that all those other mannequins might be other people that were trapped.
True.
And they're all attractive ladies.
That's true.
Almost all of them. I mean, there's a scene where a lot of commotion is happening when they're trying to sneak out and the mannequins start moving, and there's peppered throughout actual mannequins there are a few people that don't even have like masks on or anything, and they're just standing in the room,
which is a quick cuts kinda, and it's really unsettling because you kind of pick
they're
up kinda on
teetering.
It. Yeah, I would love it if they somehow managed to make this a prequel to Mannequin.
I was trying to bring it to Mannequin and you did.
Her character escaped from Lawson.
Right. Those mannequin movies. Awful. This is the only mannequin movie I like.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, and our final girl does get away, but as we see her driving off, there's a car full of people. It's her friends, and they're all mannequins, and she's got a big old grin on her face.
Yeah, she's gone completely insane.
You think that's what it is?
Yeah, she's lost her mind. She's completely cracked. Do you have a different theory?
No, it's just a freeze frame, and your theory is based, I think, maybe on like the image of her smiling, right?
Yeah.
Because leading up to that, she's just, you know, frantic, and I guess she got the car working. Huh? How does she get the car working? Anyway.
She's an ace mechanic.
Unanswered.
Yeah.
She was just hiding that from everybody. But no, my theory isn't anything. I think she's... I don't know. I think yours is right, that she's cracked. But she's coherent enough to drive, to fix a car, drive, to pile in all these mannequins of her buddies.
It's just a really roundabout way.
These people didn't deserve this.
Do I think she deserved it?
No, these people didn't deserve any of this. It's like you said,
there's no sin factor in this.
Being an attractive woman is not a sin. Being a hunky dude, right, especially the guy at the beginning who eats it.
Oh, yeah. The crowbar guy?
Yeah, is not a sin.
No.
Let's talk about that for just a minute. That's the first telekinetic stuff.
Yeah.
Where our guy at the beginning is in that room. The mannequins start moving around, and he's like, whatever. That could have been, like, mechanical, right?
Right.
But then the, is it a wardrobe? It opens, and there's a...
Yeah, starts laughing at him.
Yeah, it's got glass bottles in it, and those glass bottles get launched.
And paint.
And that's our first telekinetic stuff. That's my first time I was like, how is this even happening?
And right. Then, and you kind of forget about that scene till the reveal later.
Yeah.
Because the other stuff's explainable. But when his arm gets caught in the door, and there's a lot of things in here that are sort of primal fears, like, you know, having your face covered and you can't breathe, you know, getting your arm stuck in something and you can't run away, which again fits into that nightmare stuff.
Yeah, I just, we really glazed over that, so I figured we should give it a little bit of attention. It's true though, yeah.
Absolutely.
That guy is pretty hunky. Even our main dude,
the
guy who ends up being a mannequin himself, like, they're all pretty attractive people, and they do nothing to deserve any of this, which I think it's annoying that we watch horror movies, especially slasher movies, with the sin rule, that people deserve the deaths that they get.
Right.
I was on board when I was watching Scream, and I was like, yeah, okay, that's the thing, that's a trope, that's a rule thing. But then, much later, I was thinking, does it actually have to be that way?
No.
But it always...
And this is great, too, because this one doesn't give the killer a motivation.
No, that's why it's so scary.
Which separates it from the slasher movie. He hasn't been wronged in some way, you know, there wasn't a prank that went wrong 10 years ago, and he's getting his revenge. And I think that's where it picks up something from Halloween, where that was lost in the Halloween sequels, where it's literally just someone who is gonna kill you, and you cannot reason with them. You can't live a life in a way to avoid, you know, breaking their rules. It is just someone who is crazy, and they're gonna kill you, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that is horrifying.
Yeah.
There's no motivation.
Yeah, Rob Zombie's remake is awful, especially because he tries to justify it. Like, why?
Yeah.
Don't bother. It's a black-eyed kid. Not really. He's not one of those black-eyed children who comes to your door, but it's a soulless kid who murders indiscriminately, grows up, murders indiscriminately as a man. There's no reasoning.
Yeah, chaos and lack of rules is one of the most terrifying things. And, you know, and I talk about that on my show a lot, too, where I think people find comfort in things like vampires and werewolves and zombies because they have set rules.
Yeah.
You know, they know that they have these weaknesses that I can't exploit to get out of this.
Silver
and
bullet.
In a case like this.
Garlic.
Yeah, silver bullet.
Shoot it in the head.
Shoot him in the head. Yeah, whatever it is. But in this one, you don't have that.
No.
And there's nothing you can do.
As inexplicable as everything is, that just adds more to how unsettling it is.
Absolutely.
So, as far as the camera work goes, it's a bit pedestrian, but it's the guy's first movie, I get it. But everything else that he does, all the choices and everything. This movie's A+ as far as nightmare fuel, I think. And I don't have nightmares.
Yeah.
I didn't dream about it later. I'm just saying, it's like watching a nightmare.
Yeah, it's kind of everything you want out of a drive-in horror movie.
I would agree. Not too heavy on the exploitation, but just enough a hint here and there. It's good. Yeah, it didn't make me feel bad even watching it.
No, it's like a roller coaster ride. And it's a little grimy, but it's not Last House on the Left. It's stylish enough that you feel like there's a filmmaker who's in control of the movie. It's not like some maniacs, you know.
Yeah. Like, there's a person who has a vision for what he wants to make.
And he made some great movies later that were also, you know, very disturbing. Like, he actually directed some of the Puppet Master movies, but he made a movie in 85 with Klaus Kinski in it called Crawl Space.
Oh, that was him?
That is very unsettling. Yeah. And he has a great YouTube video. He made a short film called Please Kill Mr. Kinski, because when he was making Crawl Space in Italy, the producers said, we want you to kill Klaus Kinski. We have a big life insurance policy on him, and it is better for us if he dies making this movie. We'll make more money than this movie will make.
Oh.
And they legitimately were trying to get him to kill Mr. Kinski, and this documentary is about how he was seriously considering it.
Whoa.
It's really good. It's about 15 or 20 minutes.
I have to find... Yeah. Good golly, I gotta find that, because I remember seeing the trailer for Crawl Space, and I was like, I don't... No. I want to watch Raising Arizona.
Yeah, it's scary, and Klaus Kinski's terrifying, and it has a great Percy Rodriguez narration in the trailer with a fantastic tagline that goes, between the wall and hell, Crawl Space.
Ah, that's probably why. By the way, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's a really good Percy.
Oh, thank you.
I know you've been practicing all year. Yep. Actually, every year since that trailer came out. Well, I know you've been practicing.
He does Neon Maniacs, too.
Just for this podcast.
He does Neon Maniacs, too. He goes,
yeah,
in diabolical order.
Yeah, and then he lists the maniacs.
Biker, Doc, Juice, Slash, Soldier.
Yeah, you should have been on that episode.
Yeah, but I always recommend this. I always recommend this movie. It's a great, underrated, terrifying movie.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you did, because, you know, okay, so also in the late 90s, there's a movie called Terror Track that came out, and
yep.
I would kind of confuse these two, just because Tourist Trap and Terror Tract.
Yeah, Terror Tract was the anthology with John Ritter that was on a double feature with Cherry Falls on DVD.
I don't know about the DVD, but I know that when I worked at Blockbuster, we just had Terror Tract tape, and
yeah.
I didn't go anywhere near it. I didn't want to, but for some reason, I mixed up the titles, and so I have always have this lingering, pass on Tourist Trap in my brain. But thank you for mentioning this and wanting to do this one, because it's totally great.
Absolutely. Always happy to spread Tourist Trap around.
excuse me, do you have any Tourist Trap? I would like it to spread on my bread, as I sound like a vampire.
My Tourist Trap has spread throughout my home. Well, you know, those of us that are fans just call it TT.
TT. All right.
Yep.
Well, thank you for suggesting TT again.
Talking TT.
And so, anything else you have going on? Nothing? Nothing going on? More convention stuff?
Nothing. New TV guidance counselors every Wednesday. Doing some cons. Yeah, nothing. Nothing big. I got some merch up on the TV guidance counselor site. We got work shirts, t-shirts, sleeping bags, enamel pins. You know, that's about it.
All right. You heard it here, folks. So, Ken, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
For suggesting this. Quite enjoyed it. Good night, everybody.
Watch out for the moccasins.